Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show's Garden Life Edition, and my name is Julie Prochinski, here with Susie Perez.
Good morning, Julie. Thanks for inviting me to sit in with you today.
Great to have you, Susie. Our show today is titled Permaculture in the Garden, and for our talk, we've invited Ryan Oshker and Elizabeth Stubbe to be with us. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for having me.
But first, Susie, let's take a look at the weather.
Always a good thing. The National Weather Service is telling us right now that it is currently 66 degrees out. We have a 20% chance of thunderstorms today and before 11 a.m. and then a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 11 a.m. But mostly sunny with highs near 88. That warm weather is staying with us for a while. Calm winds becoming south 5 to 7 miles per hour in the afternoon. And again, that chance of precipitation of 20% goes all the way through Wednesday day. And so low tonight is 55 and high tomorrow is 82. It looks really pleasant and 82 degrees and sunshine through the week.
Sounds perfect. Perfect August week. But let's get going on our talk this morning. We are going to be talking about permaculture in the garden. So let's get going by giving a proper introduction to our guests. I discovered both of them at the monthly Natural Connections series at East Bonner County Library. Ryan Oshker talked about water, how to slow it, how to spread it, how to sink it, using all the permaculture ideas, and he's also owner of Breakaway Designs and a homesteader. And Elizabeth Stubbe is a return guest on Garden Life. At the library, she talked about all things plants, seeds, seed saving, growing, and everything else. She's a master gardener, an author, and a homesteader as well. Thank you both for coming in. So as a way to introduce yourselves, let's start with Ryan and tell us about your journey and your introduction to permaculture.
So my introduction to permaculture came about 2015-ish, I would say. I didn't really like the way the world looked, and I was looking for answers. So I kind of ran across permaculture through a show called The Survival Podcast with Jack Spierko. And from there, I kind of just dove into it. I ended up going to PDC over at Wheaton Labs. It was taught by Alan Booker, and I think that was in 2016 I went to that, and it was just all downhill from there. And we were living in suburbia at the time, so we pretty much did up our entire property. My neighbors thought we were absolutely insane. Just all the things we were doing, you know, we stopped spraying the lawn, so we had dandelions everywhere, and it was pretty interesting. And then we figured that to really make a good go of it, we needed some land. And where we were living at the time in Elko, Nevada, there's lots of land, and it's pretty cheap, but there's no water at all unless you drill a really deep well, and then the water's probably pretty questionable at that point, too. So we were in search of land and water. And that brought us here to this area.
And you've been here for a couple of years?
This is our fourth summer here.
Fourth summer at your homestead.
Yes.
Yes. And Elizabeth, introduce yourself.
I am a homesteader. I'm relatively new to the scene, although I grew up in the country and have always lived a pretty country life. I'm actually the first generation of my family not to have livestock as a kid. So I'm not very far removed from it, and I'm getting back to my roots, and I just run a little blog online. I do some publications, and I'm a certified master gardener. And when my husband and I moved out here to buy property and raise a family, we bought basically an unimproved piece of land. And when we were putting in or looking at planning and putting in our infrastructure, when you get into garden planning and livestock planning, you immediately run into permaculture resources. So, and us being practical and pretty like logical thinking people, it kind of comes naturally anyway, because you want to set up systems that are the best use of land. It's going to be the best use of your energy, and hopefully self-sustaining in the long term. So that was kind of how I dipped my toes into permaculture, was just setting up my homestead. And we have 20 acres, so it needed to be efficient.
That's a lot of work, 20 mm-hmm. acres. Well, 4 acres is a lot of work. It's a mm-hmm. big project. But let's back up a little bit and talk about what permaculture is. And Ryan turned me on to the prime directive of permaculture. It's to take responsibility for your own existence and that of your children. And that's in a nutshell. And it uses 3 ethics or responsibilities: earth care, people care, and fair share. And those 3 points come into each of the practices of permaculture. It's imagined as a wheel with 12 spokes. So each spoke is a directive in permaculture designing, is what they call it, because you're designing the whole place to work as one. So we'll use some of those guides as our conversation, accepting that this is a huge topic, and we'll just do our best. So Ryan and Elizabeth, let's jump in. The first spoke is wait and observe. What does that mean to you, Ryan?
I like to think of it as observe and interact, because you're really... Observation is the most powerful tool that we have as practitioners, designers, looking at the land shape, looking at what the land wants to do, and making sure that that's going to line up with what your goals are. By observing, you are interacting. You're walking those paths. You're inserting yourself into the environment. So you're already becoming a part of it just by the observation. You can't really observe without inserting yourself into it. But it's just a really good idea to stop and look and think and really come to grips with what's possible on the piece of property that you have. Because, you know, if you have 10 acres of hills, you probably shouldn't have a cattle ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just about finding what the natural system wants to do and helping encourage that.
Elizabeth, anything to add?
I really liked the point that you brought up next, actually, is how long are you going to
yes.
observe? How
yes.
long are you going to spend learning your property before you start putting in some infrastructure? And that's a really sticky wicket. I kind of wish I had waited. So we moved into our property in the winter, and obviously the next spring was like, We got to get the garden put in. We have to build the chicken coop. And I actually kind of wish that we had done more temporary structures that first year and made it through an entire cycle of seasons before deciding where everything was at. And one of the principles that we pretty much just threw out the window was the permaculture zones. Because of where our house is at, it's very poorly placed on the property. And we just had to build stuff. Like, I had to put the garden where the most sun was. That just happens to be the furthest away from the house.
Oh.
And I go out there every single day.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to work with what you have. If you are there and you're raring and ready to go, then sometimes you got to put stuff in. But keeping in mind that it's very changeable, too. As you learn, it could be 5 years and you might have to move the barn because stuff happens.
Yes.
You learn things.
Something came up out of the ground or
yeah.
whatever happened.
And no design
happened.
Is static.
Yeah.
Designs are changing constantly.
That's
well, as
a good
humans,
point.
We would like them to be static.
You would.
Yeah, it does, that's nice. Not how it works.
I did read that they said a whole cycle.
Yes.
A whole season. See all this, your land and all the seasons
ideally.
At the best. And the other thing I thought of is, how many people do you know that started gardening and went gangbusters? They put in all, you know, an acre of strawberries, and mm-hmm. 3 years later, they're tearing out that acre of strawberries because they're sick of them. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason to kind of wait, too, is just kind of to build yourself up to the idea of being a permaculture practitioner, I guess.
Yeah, and make sure your objective is clear. Like, what is your ultimate goal? And if you can really grasp that, then that will make it a lot easier. Because,
sure.
yeah, you give somebody 15 acres of land and say, wait for 1 year, I can't do that. There's no way.
The other thing that came up that I was reading about are agroforests. Now, what is that? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, so agroforestry is just making productive forestry systems.
Leaving the trees.
Leaving the trees, but enhancing it with human edible species. Oh. So there was a huge preponderance, or not preponderance, there was a huge amount of productive trees down in the Amazon. And they were looking at it and seeing that that couldn't have happened by accident. Like, the amount of productive trees that would feed humans was just way beyond what it would be naturally. So they determined that it was cultivated.
Oh.
Like, they were cultivating all these trees. So that's kind of the idea of agroforestry. And it can be set up in a lot of different ways.
Okay. So it's adding trees as a, well, the permanent is part of permaculture too, you know, permanent landscape.
Yeah, and trees are trees some of the more permanent things that we can do.
Perennials. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, perennials. The second spoke, catch and store energy. And I thought of the energy as being, you know, water, heat, and labor. So let's talk about that point, beginning with Elizabeth this time.
So I am just looking at the infant stages of my homestead. You know, I've got a 4,000 square foot garden. We've got rabbits. We've got chickens. We're looking at adding some larger livestock. My water recapture is still in the works, but one of the ways that I save water is mulching. And I am a huge proponent of mulching. It's the best thing ever that you can do for your garden. It's a way to increase your productivity if you're using like used animal bedding, which is, you know, keeping those systems in line with each other, utilizing your animal products in the garden, and then just covering, because the dirt wants to be covered. It's going to cover itself with weeds if you don't cover it, or, you know, what we consider to be weeds. It's going to cover itself with something, so you might as well cover it with something that's going to do you some good. And since I installed a drip system, I am using far less water than I have in previous years, and it's just kind of one of those things. You have to work into it.
Water's a big deal.
Yeah, it can't happen all at once.
Right. Ryan, tell us about your water experience. You're kind of...
I'll double down.
Blew
on the
my
mulch.
Mind away.
The mulch is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. For everything.
Yeah, I've got my food forest installed. And for the first couple of years, I had mulch islands where I did my guilds. And that was just to cover the ground and hopefully keep them wet a little bit. We went through a couple of really hot summers. I had to water them still. But last year, I mulched the entire food forest. I haven't watered it once this year, and it's all doing really well. We get an incredible amount of water here. I think 35 inches is around the agreed average. And we were talking a little bit before that over 1 acre, 1 inch of rain will put down 27,000 gallons of water.
Yeah, wrap your brain around that.
Yeah. So I think it's like something like 945,000 gallons per year that we could potentially do something with.
That really lit a fire in me when you talked about that at the library about, well, our roof, you know, we're in town, so we aren't catching that much water, but we have roofs all around us that are catching water and running it off. And you talked a lot about ponds, swales, and charged soil. So explain that to our listeners.
So that's really the way to store the water. I mean, you can only put so much water in a tank. There's only so many uses for water in a tank, but if you can put water in the ground, you're really doing something then. And really, it's just appropriate earthworks. And it depends on every site is different. What technique or strategy you're going to use to sink that water in. You know, if it's a pretty good slope, you might want to consider terraces. If the slope is less, swales do an amazing job. Holding ponds are great, especially if they're unlined. Then they can charge the ground right below you.
Charged means
the water is infiltrating down in, and it's if you do it well enough, you're recharging the aquifer below you. You're creating a water lens basically below your property. And I'm kind of seeing that now, like the water lens I've created kind of a little bit up higher is feeding all the plants that are down below. Like mm-hmm. the food forest is just going gangbusters this year because of all the water.
The gravity feed is another important part of moving water, is thinking about going high and coming down.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. If you can get gravity in your system, you're looking really good. And really, it's even beneficial that if you have to pump water somehow uphill to a gravity storage and then have that as storage, as saved energy, really, up there on the hill, to use that as gravity, that's a huge boost.
Good way to go.
Yeah.
How about heat? How are you storing heat to use?
Heat can be stored a variety of ways. I do rock gardens on a lot of my little areas where I want the snow to melt fast and things to start growing quickly. Building little microclimates, little keyhole gardens, or hugelkultur, kind of horseshoes, just facing south to catch the sun. That's kind of how we store heat. We're in the heat non-storage part of the year right now. We're trying to get rid of all the heat.
Do you have animals?
We do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to put heat in over winter where your animals are? Or are they?
No, mm-hmm. We don't. We don't give our animals any supplemental heat. I think that can kind of be detrimental in a lot of cases.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got chickens that have overwintered in a chicken tractor the first 2 years.
Wow.
And they were tough.
I guess.
They are unbothered.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't get any eggs, but but they did just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that taking care of your animals in the winter is a really touchy subject for a lot of people. But you realize that in these climates, as long as they're sheltered from the wind and from the moisture, and they will be absolutely fine. And I stressed out about that a lot last year, being the first year that I brought rabbits onto the property, and they were kindling in January, and I had new kits, and I was freaking out. And their mamas just tucked them into their little wool blanket that mm-hmm. they pull out of their fur and make their nest. And I'm like, I don't know what I have to worry about. They got a mom. They're good.
Yeah, that's right. Take care of themselves in a way.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm gonna revisit mulch too, because I mulch is a great way to store and make heat, composting beds. And I did hugelkultur when I first put in my first few beds, and they were very, very successful doing some of those mound gardens. And I was actually going to ask you to elaborate on the fruit tree guilds for those who don't know what that is.
Sure. Yeah, so a tree guild is basically a combination of plants that support one another. So you usually have a main plant, say like an apple tree or a nut tree. And then under that, you want to plant all kinds of things that would benefit that plant. So you would plant pollinators, things that would bring in butterflies, bees. You would bring in pest deterrers, like garlic and chives or mint that would drive things away from it. You would plant some dynamic accumulators, something like comfrey, mm-hmm. that you can kind of let grow there and chop and drop, and that's going to bring minerals up out of the soil and put it down and fertilize that tree for free, basically. It's just about creating a little closed environment where that tree doesn't really need any input from you. It can do everything on its own with the support plants around it. And the support plants can also be other things like berry bushes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I plant a lot of currants and gooseberries around in our guilds. You can put vines in, maybe when the trees are a little bit bigger later. That would make it pretty nice.
Yep, just mm-hmm. modeling nature in our cultivated areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because mm-hmm. you look at an orchard, a traditional orchard, and it's just kind of another monoculture.
Right.
And it mm-hmm. requires a lot of work and
right.
a lot of input.
That brings us to the labor part of energy. That once you get that guild established, it's pretty much on its own. It'll take care of itself. You don't water it.
No.
It's all there, interconnected and growing.
And once it's established, then you can actually go and start taking from it somewhat. I mean, we're not really getting a whole lot of fruit right now because it's year two, I think, that I have this installed. Actually, year three for most of it. but we're harvesting comfrey off of it because comfrey goes nuts. So then I'm taking the comfrey and I steep that in water for a week or two. And now I've got free fertilizer, you know, to put on all my plants.
I did that last week too.
Yeah.
And that's
we're eating
great.
Gooseberries right now.
Mm-hmm.
Raspberries are just about finished, but.
Another thing you said at the library was you talked about biochar, another energy output, and you talked about charging it. I had never heard that before. I just put biochar crumbs on my garden, and then I learned you have to charge it first. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so if it's not charged, it's just char.
Yes.
You got to put the bio in it. I'm going pretty big and geeked out on biochar for the last year. It is charcoal, but it's charcoal taken to the late stage to where there's no more volatile oils or any residues in it. It's pretty much just carbon and some minerals that aren't going to burn off. But that creates a habitat, basically, like a coral reef is the best way I've heard it described, where the biology in the soil, the bacteria, the fungi, nematodes, everything can penetrate into that and establish home base. And in our soils, like, we have a really sandy area, and so all the rain just leaches everything right out of it, right? But the biochar will hold all that water and nutrient in place. A pound of biochar will hold 7 gallons of water, which I thought was amazing.
So valuable.
So in charging the biochar, you just want to put any kind of fertility and biology that you can into it. So compost tea is great, worm tea, urine can work. What else do I put in there? I do the comfrey tea. That's another good one to put on there. If you just have like liquid kelp, that would be great. You just want to get that mixed up. Let it sit for a week or two. Let it charge. Let it fully hydrate. And then apply that to your soil.
Sure.
Quick question. This is riveting. This is really interesting. I'm so glad people are doing this in our area. And it's been around for a long time, permaculture ideas and ways of looking. But where do you get biochar? Or where do you get the char?
I make it myself. But you can buy it, but I kind of laugh when I look, like, on Amazon, the little bags of biochar. It's like a little 1 pound bag. It says it'll do like 12,000 square feet. I kind of laugh because I'm like dumping massive amounts of biochar into my garden beds. And so
I did see it bagged up at Home Depot, like a
Home Depot,
20 pound bag, but still,
there's no reason not to make it here,
right?
We have so much. To make it with.
You use things from the forest?
It's pretty much just forest material.
Yes.
Any kind of slash. You could use crop residues like corn, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Anything that was alive you can turn into biochar.
Yard waste.
So you burn it through a process called pyrolysis, where it's an excluded oxygen environment. So you're heating it, but you're keeping the oxygen out of the main body of the material.
Almost like simmering it.
Well, yeah, it heats it up and it degasses it. It gets all the volatiles out of it. And then once the burn is over, you quench it and you just put a lot of water on it. And then when you do that quickly, it also fractures it. So it comes apart and explodes and expands. And then you have all this material that you can then put back into the ground. And it'll literally stay in the ground for 1,000 years.
After you charge it.
Yes. Yeah. I think they're doing that at the woods up out of town.
That is fantastic.
It is.
I love that. It's also has something to do with our climate situation. They're looking at that as a way of putting oxygen back in or taking CO2 out of the air.
Well, our soil definitely needs more carbon.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a huge issue.
The Forest Service is using it to not leave those big bald spots where they burn those big piles.
Oh my God.
So they don't sterilize the soil under there that never recovers.
So they're starting to top light their piles now.
Yes, top light. That's the key.
So you can make biochar that way.
And
when you're doing it at scale, that's a great way to
do
it. Because a kiln or a barrel or something, that
impossible.
Would take you your entire life.
Right.
So
right.
Top lighting piles is great.
Okay. We got to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Number three. This is a big one. Obtain a yield. So that's another big part of permaculture. And a lot of times that's mostly what people think about. But you feed yourself and your family organically because you're caring for the earth. So let's talk about that. Obtaining a yield. So maybe we'll just start with soils. No dig? Mm-hmm. Is that the answer?
I think so.
Yes. I think it is what they talk about.
Yeah, I think it's becoming a lot more popular because we are still looking at an industry that's mainly controlled by monocropping, monoculture, large agriculture, big industry. And as we all know, large industries do not do things in the most renewable or the most efficient way. And when you look at putting in systems on your own property, doing something that's renewable or self-sustaining is going to save you the work. It's going to do things the most efficient way, and it's going to give you the most harvest for the least amount of input. And the whole no dig, I went with no dig because I went with raised garden beds, and then I had my son, and my physical activity was just decimated after that. I had a difficult birth. So that was why I moved away from the hugel culture. It was so much work to move everything in there, dig the hole, bury it all. And then I was like, what if I just pile it all on top? And it totally works.
Right.
And a lot of universities are coming out with more and more data on soil biology and soil culture and how it's so much improved by not disturbing the soil, not breaking up the biome. And it's just so much easier. So much easier.
Sheet composting. That's another thing that came up. And maybe that's like your guilds where you put down...
Lasagna gardening.
That's kind of how I started my my food forest and to the garden to some extent. But yeah, just putting down some fertility, some compost, covering that up with cardboard. Just layering in fertility and mulch and... That seems to go a
and very planting
long way.
Right into that.
Yeah, yep.
Yes.
When you are planting something for the purpose of harvesting it, you're actually removing organic material from that soil, and you have to put it back if you want to continue to use that soil for your best benefit. You have to enrich that soil, return the organic matter to it.
Yeah, that speaks to the previous one, the energy capture and the fertility is like. The main energy capture that I'm involved with right now, just in the beginnings of our homestead.
And soil is hard. I have not met a single person in Idaho that is like, I have great soil.
No. I haven't heard that.
It's not.
I haven't heard
they
that.
They don't. Yeah. No, it's not like Nebraska or anything, 14 feet of topsoil.
Yeah.
It's not like that. Okay, now is the time to tell us about this hugel culture. What is that? Explain that to us. That's a pretty fascinating idea.
So it's German. It means hill culture. Mm-hmm. So all it is really raised wood core gardening. So you're putting down, and really, it depends. There's all kinds of ways that you can do it for different site conditions. But essentially, you're piling up massive amounts of woody debris, any kind of biomass can do the trick. But the bigger, the better, because it's going to take longer to break down, the bigger it is. So mine, I've got a few hundred linear feet of hugel mounds, and I used all really big, you know, dead cottonwood trees, all that kind of stuff. You pile all that up in a mound, and then you either cover it with dirt or mulch, in my case, because I didn't have an area of my property I wanted to dig up to put that much dirt on that. So we're building dirt on top of the hugel mound. So we put mulch all over it.
Soil. Building soil.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry. Yes. Building soil. There's plenty of dirt.
Yes. We have dirt. That's the problem.
So once that's all covered, then it's kind of a slow start. Like you're kind of establishing everything. The mycelium and the biology are establishing themselves in there. But the idea is that when the wood is starting to break down and becomes spongy, so then it will absorb all the water from the wet season in that wood core. And it can be, I've seen hugel culture as high as 10 feet tall by 12 feet wide. just massive. And eventually you don't have to water that. So you can plant directly into it.
You do plant directly. That was going to be.
You can plant directly into it. I'm not planting directly into mine yet because it's mulched on top. I have mulch on the sides of it. And the hookah culture mound has created a water lens below. And I've got hazelnuts on one side and blackberries on the other side. And again, I've hardly watered those at all.
As the trench is decomposing. Mm-hmm. So it's alongside.
Yep.
Wow. And you don't have to water those bushes at all because they're holding it in the trench.
Yep, it's all held up in that wood.
Oh, gosh. And keyhole gardening. Give everybody an idea of what that is. That's another thing that came up.
Keyhole gardening is just kind of an architectural way to set it up. So it's a way to make use of space if you don't have a lot of space. The path, essentially, into the garden area looks like a keyhole in a traditional keyhole garden, and they can be built in a variety of ways. But the idea is you go into that keyhole, and then you have access 360 degrees around you to maintain, harvest, and do whatever you need to do with those. But also, it collects solar energy. You can buffer it from the wind by doing different height. Mm-hmm. Of plants below or behind it. It's just another strategy that may or may not work for some people.
I saw one of them at the top had the compost bin right there in the keyhole garden, you know, the right side and the left side. But the bin was, I thought that was genius. I have compost in every corner of my garden because what sense does it make to do it all in one place and haul it everywhere?
Yeah,
and
that, the less you
that
can
was
haul it.
Ingenious.
I just chop and drop. And it sounds terrible because I have a 4,000 square foot garden. I don't have a compost pile.
Oh, just drop it right where you
I just cut it down and leave it, and it adds to my mulch.
Sure.
And after I got the rabbits, I didn't really have a use for a compost pile anymore. I just threw I'm also feeding trimmings to the animals, and then you're benefiting by taking that manure, putting it back in your garden. But I was going to say, the hookah culture, I also benefited from soil warming when I was doing my annuals and my hookah culture pile. They, my tomatoes specifically, which tomatoes and peppers can be a little bit of a struggle in this climate, did noticeably better in those warmer, slow composting beds.
Yeah, you're composting. So it's creating internal heat right
now. Sure. Never thought of that. Yep. I know they used to dig down and put hot manure down below, and then they put soil on, and you'd grow in that in the cold season, but this is even easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the easier part of permaculture, not making it so labor-intensive like farming can be. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, eventually you get there. I think like the very beginning of it, for me anyway, is like the infrastructure is a lot.
Yes.
It's pretty much full time putting that in. But once the infrastructure's in, then I can kind of move to maintaining, harvesting, and enjoying a lot more.
Let's talk about seed saving too, Elizabeth, during this obtain a yield part, because I know that's one of your specialties. And
yes.
How's that going now? Are you getting your station set up, and how do you do it? How do you save your seeds?
I saw a real shift in my attitude last year because when I first started gardening, my family, I come from a very
traditional
gardening family. And I was like, oh, that's bolted. I'm so mad. And I rip it out. I really saw this shift last year where I was just like, oh, it's flowering. I'm so excited. The pollinators are going to love it. And then I can save seed from it. And it was just this bizarre flip-flop to where I am making space for things to go to seed. I'm planning to overwinter crops so that I can harvest seed from them for the next year. And the way that I made seed saving really easy on myself is just using heirlooms, because I have tried to narrow down my base varieties, the stuff that I really, really love. Like I'm growing one type of lettuce. I'm growing like one type of carrots to hopefully keep the pollination of that plant pure. And then I don't have to worry about hand pollination as much anymore. Just make it easy on yourself. Go with heirlooms, pick your favorite thing, and just put it in and let it do its thing. select the best specimens and do a little bit of reading about what that crop requires for seed saving, like mm-hmm. whether it needs to be left out to dry on the plant or whether it's better for you to bring it in and wet ferment it. We talked about that mm-hmm. a little bit at the presentation. Just a little bit of research and you'll be hooked.
That's
and on it's, finding it's a seeds in your own environment.
Whole nother part of gardening. Mm-hmm. I've really gotten into it this year as well. I've always saved my simple annual flowers, you know, my larkspurs and nigella and all those kind of flowers that come so easy, but now I'm getting serious. Oh, go ahead, Susie.
I just want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show, and it's called Garden Life. We're here with Julie Przinski, our host for this morning. We're talking with gardeners and holders of the earth and understanding the cycles of everything on the earth, Ryan Oshker and Elizabeth Stroob. So do you want to take a break?
No. Nope.
Okay,
I sure
going
don't.
Right on.
Let's go on.
Great
Let's keep
information.
Going. It's so interesting. I could talk about it all day. I've gotten books from the library, and I've just been crazy about the whole.
With the seed saving?
Yes.
Specifically with squash. What are you? Mm-hmm. Are you just doing one squash per year, like one varietal? Or
so that's really hard. I have a hard time with tomatoes and cucurbits, trying to narrow them down. But what I've been doing is just taping the flowers shut a little bit later in the season, and then doing some hand pollination on like one or two subjects. But that's more of like a nerdy gardener level thing. And when it can be kind of daunting. When you're looking at all the information about, I need to have my corn isolated by 5 miles in order to get pure pollination. It doesn't necessarily have to be that hard. And you can utilize succession planting as well, which you had on the list to talk about. If you have let's use carrots for an example. If you have two different types of carrots, they have a relatively short days to maturity, which means from the day that you're planting that seed to when that crop is mature is relatively short. If you want to grow two or three different types of carrots, all you have to do is plant the first carrot early in the season, then plant the second carrot halfway through the season, plant the third carrot a little later, and they'll be flowering at different times. Mm-hmm. And then you can try to keep your pollination pure.
Can you bag the top? Can you
mm-hmm.
bag?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can use paper bags. I use organza bags too. Mm. And mm-hmm. my husband actually just got me this really fancy little tapey gun machine so that I can mark stuff to keep track of what I have pollinated and what I'm like, don't pick that. I need that.
Yeah, I flagged my
yes.
my seed saving plants just yep. so nobody messed around with them, because they'd look kind of ratty in the garden by the end.
Well, or it's like the best looking tomato and you're like, don't nobody touch it.
Yeah,
I
yes.
need that.
That's right.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
best looking plant from the most extreme conditions.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The one that does the best in your environment is the one that you want to propagate. And it can be hard because you really just want to eat it, but you got to leave it if you want it to continue to procreate.
That's right. Looking to the future.
Mm-hmm.
Raising animals. So do you raise your bedding for your rabbits and your chickens, or how do you bring straw in, or how do you bring straw in, Ryan? I mean,
So right now we are bringing in straw. Yeah.
Me too. I live in a forest situation, so it would be ridiculous for me to try and grow field crops.
Okay.
It's not the best use of my property, but what I try to do and what we've done since we've had our property is source locally.
Yeah.
The best mm-hmm. thing you can do if you can't produce something within your ecosystem or from your property is to get it from somebody who's local.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, I'm looking at patches of deciduous trees on my property this year to see if I can gather up enough, like cottonwood leaves, birch, maple, all that kind of stuff to maybe replace some of that.
Pine needles.
Pine needles. But yeah, at this point, we're bringing in straw.
Mm-hmm. You can come into town and get as many leaves as you need come fall.
That's yeah.
It's true.
I was talking about that with my wife as a strategy. We might do that. We've done that before.
Yes.
In different places we've lived.
Wood chips too.
Yeah.
Because
oh.
there's so much material available for chipping, and I use wood chips on everything.
Yeah, we run a deep litter system with our American guinea hogs, mm-hmm. and we put in fresh wood chips about once a week, and then about once a month, I harvest all that out of there and build a giant bioreactor compost pile.
Yep.
And, yeah.
That's terrific. Okay, we got to get to number four before we're coming down to the
Go
end.
Go, Julie.
Okay, I'm going. The number four was an interesting rule, I guess, or suggestion. Apply self-regulation and accept feedback. And under that comes the climate change, chemicals, GMOs. So explain to us what that means to you, Ryan. Go ahead and start with that one.
So as far as like applying self-regulation, that kind of brings me back to the permaculture ethics and the original ethics out of the designer's manual that Bill Mollison wrote was care of earth, care of people. And the third one was kind of a sticky one. And he wrote limit population and consumption.
Right.
The original third ethic. It sounds kind of authoritarian, and you think of like eugenics or something like that when that's spoken sure. about. But really what he was talking about is carrying capacity. I mean, the land only has so much carrying capacity.
That's a great term.
And that's a very logical way to think about it. So I landed on not the fair share part of it, but return of surplus. That kind of, I think, distills down his original ethic that sounds clunky. You know, you said people care, earth care, and then, you know, limit population and consumption. But I think, yeah, return of surplus. Mm-hmm. So you're taking the surplus that you have and putting it back into the land or the people that are on that land. And if you're not doing that, it kind of turns into like a resource mining operation where you're taking from your land and spreading it out and depleting your land.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's kind of what's going on in agribusiness as a whole.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I see applying self-regulation is making sure that everything is closed loop. And then when you're actually producing more than you can handle, then maybe you need to spill that over to your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
and because they're not where you're at yet. And then they'll get there, and then they can spill that over. And it just kind of creates a chain or a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm. Grows wealth.
Yeah, real wealth.
I wanted to mention, too, when you were talking about how much the land can support life, I wanted to mention hunting, fishing, and foraging as also working that into your permaculture practice, because before we had a lot of production coming off of our property, and still, I maximize my local environment and talk about a place to do permaculture. Yeah. Idaho is like up there and one of the best places to be if you want to be self-sufficient. Foraging is year-round mm-hmm. in this climate. Fishing and hunting are year-round in this climate, and that is another way to introduce more usable material and harvest to your personal permaculture system, even if you don't have property, because those are three things that you can do to turn your waiting room into a classroom.
Right.
Is to use nature and the environment around you to maximize your harvest, even if you're not bringing it off your own land.
Mm-hmm.
Be a good steward.
Absolutely. Yep. The other thing is that I had read is it's a way to focus on behaviors we want to increase and discourage inappropriate activity by sharing. I think that's
Make
what that's
gardening
all about.
Cool again.
That's right. I think it is cool again.
It's a way of building community intentionally.
It's having a huge renaissance.
And that's why permaculture is different than like homesteading, is permaculture is. Community is one part of the three-part prong of permaculture is community. So it's care of people.
And you had mentioned GMOs, and I just wanted to touch on if you wanted to.
Sure.
Had you heard or have you guys talked about the purple tomato?
Yes. Well, I think we might have talked about it when you were in last.
Yeah, that it's a really good example of what do you want to introduce into your local ecosystem? And what I'm referring to is generally GMOs have not been available to the public. And just this year, they have introduced a tomato that is genetically modified. It was crossbred with a snapdragon. And it has now been made available for home gardeners to grow in their garden. And when you're bringing a plant, especially a flowering plant, into your local ecosystem that is genetically modified, you are potentially opening that Pandora's box of, I don't want to say tainted genetics, but that's what it is.
Unknown consequences.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a decision that I was glad that you put that note in there, because mm-hmm. it's a decision you have to make personally. What you want to do about that. Do you want to include that in your local ecosystem? And it's not renewable, for sure.
And to watch by for design. That. Mm-hmm. By design, exactly. Oh my gosh, we are almost out of time here. Let's, we touched on the core principles and learned about this discipline, and we talked about how earth and family and sharing is all part of the permaculture promise. But let's go one last time to Ryan and Elizabeth and give us any last thoughts you have about permaculture going forward.
I think that this whole back to earth, kind of back to Eden movement is really great. Get your kids involved. If you're going to set up permaculture, you're going to set up a garden, get your kids out there. Even if they're whining about it, it's so good for them. It's good for you. It's good for your kids. It's been an amazing movement to see.
It's fabulous.
And there's no better place to do it.
There isn't. And that's a huge reason we're doing what we're doing, is to give our kids a completely different life than what's being prescribed normally. I can't even get into how much it's changed how we do things. And every month it seems like we find some new string to pull and go down that rabbit hole, and it makes our lives better every time we do it.
And you say ours as a family. Mm-hmm. This is something you're doing as a family.
And it can seem a little daunting when you're looking at all these systems and keywords and just start small.
Yes.
If it's a worm bin or a raised bed or going mushrooming or huckleberry picking, start with something. And I promise you will not get enough of it.
Right.
Yeah, one thing leads to another.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's a domino effect, and of the best kind.
One of the things I've always noticed is that farmers, gardeners, people who are part of the earth love to share what they've learned. Is there a group of permaculture? Is that the permaculture promise? Is there a group? Or do you just ask your neighbor? Some of the key things that you can learn from each other mm-hmm. so much. I mean, obviously there's books, but is there a group here in North Idaho?
Facebook is great too.
I don't have Facebook. I know of like the Inland Northwest Permaculture Gathering. I'm not sure. Heard that's maybe on hold this year due to the person that was hosting it passing away. But hopefully, I mean, I've met a ton of people in that group and a bunch lately that I was pretty blown away. I'm always happy to meet people that are into permaculture.
Yes.
And some of the people I've met have been into permaculture, you know, for 30 years.
Yes.
And it's pretty awesome. I always feel like I'm meeting like some kind of a Jedi or something when I meet one.
Sage. Speaking of sharing information, Ryan, how would people get in touch with you? Tell us a little your breakaway.
So yeah, I run Breakaway Design. I do consultations for people on their land. I do pretty much anything that they want to do. We just figure out what the ultimate goals are, and I can help design that in.
Good.
I don't really have an internet presence.
We found out, right, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I pretty much stay offline. We're actually considering maybe getting rid of the internet at our house. Maybe. I'm not sure yet.
It's not bad. You'll like it.
Are you no internet at the house?
The first year we lived there, we didn't have internet, and we got a lot done.
Yeah, I'm seeing, just by like mediating my usage, I'm seeing that. So anyway, I'm on Telegram at Breakaway Design. You can email me, breakawaydesign@protonmail.com. That'd probably be the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay. And Elizabeth, contacting you?
I have a little bit of a web presence. I run a blog, and I got into that when I was learning to get back to the land. I just decided I wanted to pay it forward with the information that I was gathering. So I write about my experiences, and I share recipes, and that's the Whistling Rooster Homestead. I have a garden planner and some other little things available on the website. But yeah, all my contact information is online. Facebook, Instagram, my blog is where I'm most active.
So Elizabeth Stuby,
Whistling Rooster Homestead.
Whistling Rooster Homestead. And Ryan Esker.
Breakaway
Designs. Thank you both so much for being here. It's just been a great conversation. I might have you back on for the next four steps. But together, permaculture is building a slower and more sustainable life for you, your families, and really, it'll rise up and change the world. It could. So thank you so much for being with us.